Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Welcome all of you to today and today onward this series of talks on from grudging to gratitude. In our life, the physical and the mental often go out of sync. Now we know if we are watching a homemade video. And in that video, say the person has done the audio recording using one device and the video shooting has been done on another device and the two are not synced properly. And then somebody drops a glass. And then before the glass is even left behind, the cracking sound comes. So when things are out of sync, they become very, they don't function properly. You can't enjoy the video, whatever we are watching. So in the movie, what has happened is the visual and the audio, they've gone out of sync. So when things go out of sync, then proper functionality cannot take place. Am I audible properly? There's a little echo. It's okay?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. So, similarly, for us, when we exist as conscious beings, we are physically at a particular place. But frequently, our mind is not at that place. And when the body and the mind are out of sync, now we usually refer to such people, if they are habitually like that, we may call them absent-minded. Now, absent-minded doesn't mean that the mind is absent little. Mind is always there. The mind always exists. The mind is always present in the sense of existing in the sense that it is present. But it is present somewhere other than where the body is present. So the person may be talking with someone and suddenly, hey, come to earth. The person is in dreamland, lost somewhere. So basically when the body and the mind go out of sync, then we can't function properly. Now, there are many things which may cause the body and the mind to go out of sync. Where we are physically, we are not mentally there. The Bhagavad Gita explains that our existence is three-dimensional. There is the body, the mind, and the soul. So the body, if you can compare to a computer, the body is like the hardware. The mind is like the software. And the soul is like the user. So, now, the hardware is, if you want to do some work on a computer, we need the hardware. And primarily the hardware is that what we see. You know, if somebody's computer has a big crack, yes, what happened? What happened to your PC? Or somebody's computer has become very discolored, very lot of dirt in there. What happened? To take care of the computer, what happened? So basically, when you can see something wrong with the so if there's something wrong with the physical structure of the computer, we can see it very easily. But if the computer is infected by a virus, then at a physical level the computer may appear to be perfectly functional, but the computer cannot function at all. Because the software is impaired. Similarly, some of us may be physically very healthy. But sometimes the mind, which is like a software, that gets impaired. And now when the impairing of the mind happens, what exactly happens at that time? As I said, the mind can get impaired in various ways. But the mind is the channel of consciousness. So, what does it mean, channel? Say, for example, if I'm sitting here and I want to look what is there outside the door. Now, if this room is completely dark and in this room there's nothing except that door, which is the source of light, then only when I look at that door and through that door can I see what is outside. So, the door is literally the door for my vision. That's where how I can see outside. So, the soul, say, is like the person sitting here. The door is the mind. And from that, what we see outside is the world. So the mind is like a door for the soul. The soul is the root of consciousness. R-O-O-T, root. It is the source of consciousness. The mind is the root of consciousness. R-O-U-T-E, the path. So from the root of consciousness, that is the soul, through the mind, which is the root of consciousness, the path for consciousness, our consciousness comes out. Now sometimes, the door may be closed. If the door is closed, I won't be able to see anything. But the mind is a much more peculiar kind of door. It is meant to be the root of consciousness. We need the mind. Whenever we perceive something, if we perceive not just with our eyes. Now, sometimes we may be there looking at someone. But if we are lost in our thoughts, then we don't see. Hey, what happened over there? Or we are talking with someone, we get lost. What did you say? Sometimes when we are hearing a class, sometimes we sit physically, but our mind goes off for a jog. It goes here, goes there. And then suddenly there's a joke in the class. And people look, hey, what happened? What happened? I don't want to miss the joke. I want to know what it is. So the mind basically runs back. And thinks there's something entertaining over here. So basically, perception in the sense of something entering into the senses. Say the vision entering into our eyes. That perception is what happens when the senses come in contact with external objects. Eyes come in contact with forms. Eyes come in contact with forms. The ears come in contact with sound. This is when perception happens. But actually, that perception doesn't register within us. The perception doesn't happen. In a sense, the sensory information enters into our eyes. But it doesn't register with us if the mind is not there. This is the external object. These are the eyes. This is the mind. And this is the soul. So only when the mind is present over there, does what we see register. Otherwise, it doesn't register. So if the door is closed, somebody might be there outside. I won't be able to see them. So the mind, which is meant to be a channel for consciousness, can become the blocker of consciousness. It doesn't allow our consciousness to go anywhere, wherever it is meant to go. But the mind doesn't just block our consciousness. The mind channels our consciousness elsewhere. Suppose I have a door. And on that door, through that door, if it is open, I see what is there outside. But if instead of that door, somebody puts a TV screen over there. And then suddenly some channel starts off over there. Now when the channel starts off over there, I may think I am looking at the door. But actually I am seeing something else which is happening somewhere else entirely. On that TV channel there might be a cricket match going on. There might be a movie going on. There might be a dozen other things going on. And then we get caught in watching that. We just get lost in our thoughts. And we forget where we are. And the mind basically can, in that way, desync us from the body. So we are at a particular place, but we are not at that place because our consciousness is not there. Our consciousness has gone somewhere else. Now sometimes absent-mindedness is just funny. The typical example of, say, absent-minded people, they put their specs on their forehead. They're searching everywhere. Where are my specs? Where are my specs? So they're there, but they're not aware of it. This kind of absent-mindedness is just humorous. But sometimes, the absent-mindedness of the mind, rather the mind is not being present where it is, that can also be far more than not just humorous. It can be dreaming. It can be dangerous also. So when our topic today is, we're going to start this journey with the grudging. So the way we are going to discuss is that when we face problems in life, at that time, one of our mental responses is that we go into a grudging, resentful mode. So we'll try to understand, in a sense, how our mind sabotages us when we grudge and how grudging harms us. At a more philosophical level, we'll understand that today. Tomorrow in the first session, You know, whenever we face a problem, we attribute a cause. What is the cause of it? So, we'll see how, whatever happens in our life, how exactly is Krishna related with that? You know, Krishna is not the cause of our problems. He's ultimately the cure for our problems. And that in the second session. And the third session, we'll discuss about how even amidst the problematic situations, you know, we can look for reasons to be grateful. That is the power of aggressive gratitude. Now, why aggressive gratitude? Because normally when you talk about aggression, aggression means, say, a country has a particular territory, but then they invade into another territory and then they occupy that territory. That's called aggression. So, when you talk about aggressive gratitude means there are certain things for which we will feel grateful when they work out. But when we take our consciousness out of that territory and take it into territory about which we will not normally feel grateful, but find ways to be grateful, then that is aggressive gratitude. And in the last session, I'll talk about how we can, once we understand that there are things to be grateful for, we often talk about count your blessings. But we'll talk not just about counting our blessings, we'll talk about making our blessings count. That means, whatever are the positives in our life, how to help ensure that they work for us. That we can actually not just conceptually think about positive positively, but bring positivity into our life. That's the journey we'll take. And right now I'm giving the conceptual background. So when we become resentful, what essentially happens? So if we consider this as the timeline along which certain life is moving. So at event, at time, at coordinate A, say, at point A, a particular event happens in our life. Somebody speaks something to us. Somebody does something to us. Just something just happens. You know, say, I'm going for a program and my car breaks down. Or, you know, somebody's promised to do something and they just forget to do it. Or we expected a support of someone and they instead criticize us. So, something unexpected, something unpalatable happens. Now, when this happens, life moves on. You know, the time A, the moment A, it has happened, it moves on. Now, we come to time B, time C, time D. But our mind gets stuck over there. You know, how could he say that? Why did she do that? How could this have happened? Why? So when that happens, when our mind gets locked in the past, in a particular event which has happened and which we're just not able to accept. We just can't digest that this has happened. So at one level, our emotions are just natural mental responses to situations. For example, say I'm sitting on, so just as we have natural physical responses, similarly we have natural mental responses. So for example, say if I'm sitting on this sofa and suddenly I feel it's very cold, then I may move to another side. So there is a stimulus of cold and then there's a movement to respond to that cold. So that if suddenly I find there's some mosquito biting me, I move my hand away. So these are instinctive responses which we have, the physical reflexes. So the pain and the discomfort or whatever I feel at a physical level, that's a just natural human response to that stimuli which I have. So similarly, when something goes wrong, you know, to get frustrated, to feel irritated, to feel angry, to feel resentful, these are natural human responses at the mental level. At the same time, we have the capacity to decouple our actions from our emotions. It's like sometimes I feel hungry. Now when I feel hungry, my normal response is I will eat food. So there is hunger, the sensation of hunger comes in as an emotion, and then the normal response is, I eat food. But suppose I am fasting. I may be dieting, I may be fasting for the holy birth, religious purpose, I may be fasting for just for better health or whatever. If I'm fasting, then what happens? I feel the sensation. I feel the emotion of hunger. But I say, I will not eat. And that is determination. So we all have this capacity for determination. You know, say if a cat sees a mouse, the cat cannot think, oh, today is Ekadashi. I have to fast. Today is a sacred day where I'm supposed to fast. The cat can't think like that. Why not? Because it doesn't have the capacity. For the cat, as soon as there is the sensation, oh, it's food, it's action immediately. So for us, there is the capacity to decouple sensation and associate emotion, the sense that emotion from action. And that capacity is our determination. So it is natural to feel irritated, to feel resentful when something goes wrong. However, it is not natural to hold on to that feeling. To hold on to that feeling is not only not natural, it is harmful. In the Bhagavad Gita, in the 18th chapter, Krishna talks about three kinds of determinations. He talks about determination in the mode of goodness, determination in the mode of passion, and determination in the mode of ignorance. So the modes of material nature are basically subtle forces. The three gunas that are talked about in the Bhagavad Gita. This is the conceptual framework for psychological analysis the Bhagavad Gita gives. It says the modes basically are subtle forces that shape the interaction between matter and consciousness. Between matter and consciousness. So, when we see a particular object, how we respond to it, that is determined by the mode we are situated in. So, in the same object, person A may be seen in goodness and they will respond in a particular way. Person B sees in passion, they respond in a different way. Person C sees in ignorance, they respond in a third way. So, for example, say, three people are riding in a bus. And when they are riding in a bus, say the first person is in goodness, sattva-guna, second is in passion, raja-guna, third in tamo-guna. Now, the person in tamo-guna, in the mode of ignorance, just is lazy, apathetic, just trying to sleep. And the bus is moving a little bit, jolting, can't sleep. And they look out, and there's a lush greenery outside. The person in ignorance thinks, such soft grass, so comfortable. I could sleep so nicely there. The second person is in the mode of passion. And as soon as they see my passion, and because they're in the mode of passion, as soon as they see greenery in the forest, they remember the latest romantic movie that they had seen. And they remember some romantic scene they had seen in some forest. And they think, if only I had someone with me, I would enjoy. Same perception. Third person is in the mode of goodness. See, they are trying to read a book. The bus is moving up and down. They're not able to focus on reading. They look out in there. Lush greenery. Such a peaceful place. I can sit calmly and immerse myself in the wisdom of this book. So what has happened? Same perception, same object it is perceived, but it's perceived very differently. That is because of the mood which a person is in. So the modes are subtle forces that shape the interaction between matter and consciousness. So the material objects that we see, how they will influence us, that will vary depending on the particular mode that we are in. So, whatever mode we are in, we perceive things accordingly. Some of you probably know the story of the alcoholic, anti-alcohol campaigner. Once he was giving a class about how dangerous alcoholism is, why we should give it up. So, he decided to give a live demonstration. And he got up, he was talking about the dangerous effect that alcohol has on the body. And finally, he had a small box, which he had kept a fly. He had a bottle of
at a glass of alcohol. He opened the box and just flung the insect into the bottle. The insect fluttered about and just sank down. And then sank down. So what do you learn from this? He was obviously talking about how dangerous alcohol is. And so all the alcoholics were there, started looking down. Now one of them was very jolly, looking up eagerly. He says, so what do you learn? Raising his hand. He says, what do you learn? He says, I learned that whenever I drink alcohol, all the germs in my stomach will die.
So here,
the same object is perceived, but it's perceived based on how one is thinking, on which mode one is in. So the modes offer us self-affirming visions of reality. Self-affirming visions of reality means when I'm thinking of a particular thing, then the particular mode which I'm in, I see things in a way that affirms my version of reality. Whatever I am thinking about, I see only those things which reaffirm whatever I am thinking about. So why are we talking about the modes right now? Krishna says that resentment, the negativity associated with resentment, this is typical of the mode of ignorance. Yaya swapnam bhayam shokam vishadam madameva cha navimunchati durmedha. So he says, Dhruti is determination. Sapartha tamasi. Tamasi means in the mode of ignorance. So determination in the mode of ignorance, what does it mean? It means, normally we use the word determination in a very positive sense. Somebody is very determined. So, you know, although there are so many obstacles, they're holding on to, going on, pressing on, that's their determination. So yes, determination is normally positive, but sometimes if someone holds on to something which hurts them, something which harms them, then that we usually refer to as obstinacy, stubbornness. We use the negative describers for describing it. But still the point is that person is holding on to it, although it's hurting them. So determination in the mode of ignorance basically means obstinacy or stubbornness, where we hold on to something which hurts us. So normally, suppose, you know, there is an iron bar, and that iron bar is red hot. You just touch it, burns me. Now if I accidentally happen to touch it, then even then, actually, so even if I accidentally happen to touch it, I will immediately let go of it. But suppose somebody somehow holds on to that iron bar, holds on. See, what are you doing? You're hurting yourself. So it is let go. No, hold on. Let go. No, hold on. That requires determination to hold on. But it is a perverse determination. The perverse determination which actually hurts the person. So in the Mahabharata, one of the central characters named Dhritarashtra. So Dhritarashtra, the word, he is a very attached king. And although because of his attachment, he is ready to even do nefarious activities. Give consent in the killing of his relatives. So his own nephews. So he just does that because he's so attached. Now the word Dhritarashtra, it literally means, Dhruta means to hold on. Rashtra means country or state, kingdom. So one is strongly holds on to the kingdom. Now this word can have both a positive connotation and a negative connotation. Dhritarashtra can mean one who strongly holds on to the kingdom and protects the kingdom. Protects the kingdom against plunderers, against thieves. A Dhritarashtra can also have a negative connotation where it means and the person is attached to and holds on to it. So normally the character of Dhritarashtra is associated with this negative characterization, where he was very attached. So
So now that holding on requires determination. Now, when we are resentful, what are we doing? We are mentally holding on to something which hurts us. And Krishna says this requires determination. To hold on to something which is painful, it requires determination. But if that painful, holding on to something painful, if that is purposeful, say if I'm falling off from a mountain cliff and there's a rope dangling and I hold on to it, then my whole body weight is falling on my arms and my arms are pain. But at that time when I hold on, that holding on is purposeful. So pain itself is not a problem. Any kind of determination involves tolerating some pain. But if that pain has some purpose, then it is positive. But if the pain has no purpose, I am holding on to something which I don't need to hold on to. Am I holding on to iron bar and my hands are burning? That is self-destructive. That is self-torturing. So resentment is like that. Krishna says, Aya sopnam bhayam shokam vishadam madamevacha namumanchati durmedha navimunchati. Such a person who does not give up. Durmedha, their intelligence is misdirected. Because of the misdirected intelligence, they don't give up holding on to the things which are hurting them. What are their things? Krishna talks about 5 things. Yeah, swapnam, daydreaming. Yes, the person is idly daydreaming, does nothing. I'll do that. But they practically don't do anything. Silent daydreamers. Yeah, swapnam, bhayam, constantly fearful. What if this happens? What if that happens? See, fear is natural and fear is not undesirable. Whenever there is a fear, is just a natural human response to danger. Whenever, if you are looking down from a 100-story building and we see such a big drop, we feel fear. That fear is a natural human response to danger and it protects us. Now, if a child looks down from a 100-story building and doesn't feel fear, the mother will become fearful by that. Hey, come on! So fear is natural. Fear is in some ways desirable. But fearfulness is not desirable. When I am not looking down at that 100-story fall, so if I am thinking, oh, what if I fell down? This is a dangerous fall. What will happen? So fearfulness is a problem. So in fearfulness, what are we doing? We are mentally holding on to that which causes us negativity, which causes us anxiety. Yeah, swapnam bhayam shokam. Shokam is lamentation. That means something has happened, something has gone wrong, and still, why did this happen? And this is what we are talking about, resentment. It's related with lamentation. And then Krishna says, so, yeah, swapnam bhayam shokam, vishadam madamev. Swapna and bhaya, daydreaming. I do like this, that will happen. Bhaya, fear. These two are about the future. You know. Shoka, lamenting, this may go wrong, that may go wrong. Or no, why did this happen? Why did that happen? You know, that is about the past. Now, vishadam. Vishada means moroseness. And some people are habitually negative. No matter whatever we tell them. They always find some problem with it. Even if the best thing happens in their life, they say, what if this goes wrong? What if that goes wrong? These are morose people. So, vishadam madam evacha. Madam means intoxication. Some people, they just can't deal with life. So they feel there is no problem whose solution can't be found at the bottom of a bottle of alcohol. Drink and forget. Right? Madamayuch. Now all these, actually when they drink alcohol, they temporarily feel high. But afterwards, they make a fool out of themselves. They act in an embarrassing way. They spoil their health. They waste their money. They hurt their relationships. So it in the long run hurts. But they still keep doing it. These are, Krishna says, determination in the mode of ignorance. Now in such determination, we are holding on to something which is undesirable. And what is that? In our case, we are discussing when we are resenting, you know, something has already happened, it has gone wrong. But why did this happen? Why? That question just eats us up mentally. We are just left powerless, incapable of doing anything at all. So, now, if I give the example of a journey, of a life journey, in terms of time. So, I start, we are at time A, something happened. Now, we move on to time B. We have moved on, the world has moved on, but we are mentally stuck in there. Why did this happen? Why? So, basically then what has happened? We are, our body and our mind are out of sync. Our body is in time B. Our mind is in time A. And A and B can be different places also. If something happens in office, we come home and we are irritated. Why did this happen? So, again, we are out of sync basically. At this time, when we are resentful like this, this resentment, it prevents us from moving ahead in life. Basically, we all will move. Life moves on and we need to move on with it. So suppose if we are going in a car journey. Now, if we drive the car, if we move the steering, we turn on the engine, the car starts moving. Now, if I press the brakes, it says press the brakes, the car just can't move. The car will stay on over there. All that will happen is a lot of noise. If I am moving the car and it's in the proper gear, I'm moving the steering wheel, the engine is on and the brake is also on. All that will happen is a lot of friction. The car will not move on. The brake will cause the machinery wants to move on, but the brake is stopping it. It causes a lot of internal friction. Like that, for us, now, if we consider our body, it moves on. Life moves on and physically we move on from one thing to another. But mentally, we stay stuck somewhere. So it's like mentally, there's a brake pressed on our consciousness. And with the brake pressed on our consciousness, we stay somewhere else. Why did this happen? Why did he do that? Why did she do that? How could this have done? And this question is on and on and on and on and on. When that happens, then we just become paralyzed. Paralyzed not necessarily physically, but mentally. Mentally we become paralyzed. We go through life, but it's just existing. We're not really living. We're filled with so much negativity. So this resentment, it saps our energy. And now the word grudging is used in a particular sense. Where somebody has done something wrong against us and we hold on to it. So the grudging is one scope, one aspect of resentment. It's with respect to people. But this person did like this, this person did like that. When we do that, basically we may think I'll get back at that person. But we are hurting ourselves more. We are hurting ourselves more than we will ever hurt them. We think, I'll get back at that person. But we cause far more negativity in ourselves than what we can cause to them. How is that? Because basically, whenever we are resentful, whenever we are angry, whenever we are filled with a grudging attitude, then all that creates negativity within us. And that negativity, just so much life goes through, so much we go through, but we just can't think about it because we are mentally somewhere else. We don't experience life. And even if we get back at that person, even if we take revenge, okay, I got back, brought after that. Okay, it's over. Now usually, we get back at that person and then that person also wants to get back at us. It just goes on. Now, how to respond to people when they hurt us, that is a whole different subject. And we'll discuss that in a later class. Basically, speaking, there are three, when somebody has hurt us, there are three broad responses which we can have. One is, we just change ourselves and tolerate. The second is, we change the situation or change the person. The third is, we walk away from the situation, walk away from the person, walk away from the relationship. Now, It is not that one is right and the other is wrong. When we are saying that we shouldn't be resentful, it doesn't mean that we should always tolerate whatever anyone else is doing. And we should just let them trample upon us. No, not at all. The point is that we shouldn't let that person mentally dominate us, mentally control us. Now, all these three ways of acting, you know, changing ourselves and tolerating, acting to change the other person, and walking away, all these three are valid responses in different situations. In the Mahabharata, the Pandavas demonstrate all these three responses at different times. Initially, when they come to the kingdom, which belongs to them actually, but Duryodhana, their cousin, was expected to become the king. And then next, Duryodhana, when he sees himself displaced from the center of attention, the center of affection, he becomes very envious and starts plotting. Although just a teenager at that time, by the way, just a reminder, sometimes I tend to become very fast in my speaking. So, if any of you find that I'm speaking too fast for you to understand, please raise your hand and let me know. I usually have on my computer a slide saying, slow down. But my computer was stolen in America, so this is somebody else's computer. I don't have that slide here. So, if any of you find that I'm speaking fast, please just raise your hand and let me know. I can slow down at that. Was I too fast till now, even? Thank you. So initially, when Duryodhana tries to poison the Bhima, later on they try to, Duryodhana arranges so that Pandavas are attempted to be burned alive. Throughout it all, the Pandavas' head, Yudhishthira says, just don't, it's a family matter, don't escalate it. Just don't read it. He tolerates it. But then later on, when the Pandava's wife, Draupadi, is publicly dishonored, and the Kauravas show no repentance at all, then the Pandavas decide, under Krishna's guidance, that now the time for action has come. And they fight a war. They fight a war to make sure that dharma, the rule of virtue, is established. So the Bhagavad Gita, on one level, it tells Arjuna to tolerate. Matra sparshas to kaunte shitoshu sukha dukkala agam apayino nityastam sitiksha subhata. In 2.14 in the Gita, Krishna says that temporary things, pleasure is temporary, pain is temporary. Just tolerate it. Don't get worked up about it. Although Krishna is telling Arjuna to tolerate pleasure and pain, Krishna doesn't. The same Bhagavad Gita tells Arjuna, you have to fight a war. Now, I'll come to this point again also later, but Krishna does not tell Arjuna to fight for getting revenge. And later on, Krishna says in the 11th chapter, 55th verse, Nirvairah sarva bhuteshu, fight without any feeling of animosity towards anyone. So he fights, the Pandavas are not fighting to take revenge. They are fighting to establish dharma. They are fighting to establish dharma. So at that time, although Krishna is telling Arjuna to tolerate, that doesn't mean he says tolerate the atrocities of the Pandavas, of the Kauravas, sorry. So at that time they take action. So taking action is also a valid form of response. And later on, the Pandavas, when Krishna departs from the world, when Krishna departs from the world, at that time, the Pandavas decide, enough is enough. We are also leaving. This walk away. They leave the kingdom and renounce the world. Enough of this entanglement in politics. Enough of this. Krishna has sent us for a mission. It's done. Krishna is departing. We will depart. Now, walking away is different from running away. Now, when we run away from problems, now our primary focus is where we are going away from. Now, I want to be anywhere except here. So, although I'm running away here, I am running away from here, still what is here is dominating my consciousness. I am running primarily because of fear. And usually running away doesn't solve problems. Right? Simply, problems will come back in some other form. Now, walking away, on the other hand, means that I understand I have better things to do in my life. You know, this particular problem, this particular issue, it's too messy. It's not worth the time to fight. It's not worth the time to resolve. Just forget it and move on with life. So when we walk away from a problem, it is because we understand there is a higher purpose to life. It is not because this problem is so difficult I'll run away from it. It is because that this problem is difficult. I can tackle it if I want to. But it's not worth the effort. Just walk away from the situation. Now all three are valid responses. But none of these three will be valid if we hold on to a resentful attitude. Now when we hold on to a resentful attitude and we tolerate the resentment, I keep tolerating one thing, two things, three things, four things. And eventually that resentment will explode. That's a job. You know, sometimes you know, we speak something and another person suddenly explodes. What happened? It's a small thing. But for them, that one small thing was just a tip of a mountain. So many other things are climbing up. They're piling up in their consciousness. And they explode at that time. So if we don't process that resentment, we let it pile up. It'll crush us. It'll burden us. It'll crush us. We'll start feeling sorry for ourselves. We'll wallow in self-pity. So, if that negative emotion is not processed, if I'm tolerating with resentment, then we'll just be crushed by negativity, by self-pity. On the other hand, when if I act to change things, but I'm acting resentfully, you know, then basically we will usually end up complicating matters. Because the resentment will not allow us to think rationally. And the spell of resentment, we will do things which the other person is not able to see why they are so angry. We'll simply make things worse at that time. And even if we go away, we will be running away from the problem. And still that problem will dominate us. Why did they do that? How could they have done that? Why did this have to happen to me? So all three responses can be valid. If they're done with proper understanding, with proper deliberation, and all the responses, you know, tolerating, changing, or walking away, all three can become counterproductive if they're done with resentment. Now, how do we deal with resentment? Now, specifically, various measures, we'll be talking about in tomorrow's class. But at this point, we just need to understand without any doubt that resentment is harmful. The mind sometimes is so perverse that it likes to make a martyr out of ourselves. You know, I suffer and then I think, oh, I suffered so much for you. I suffered so much for them. Well, there is, every relationship involves some trouble, some amount of tolerance, some amount of trouble. Sometimes we just pile up trouble on ourselves and we think, I'm so great because I'm doing this. And then, although we think like that, we are feeling very resentful internally. So, resentment is harmful. Grudging is harmful. It is, even if we get back at others and we hurt others, that's not going to help. Because we have hurt ourselves far more. And when we hurt the other person, they're also going to hit back. That's also going to hurt us. So, when we are hurt by something which causes a resentment, the first thing is not to get back. The first thing is to get safe. Now get back at others. Get back at others means you do it like this, I will do 10 times more. When we think like that, we are consumed by the negativity over there. So suppose somebody bites us, a snake comes and bites us. We're walking along the road, the snake bites us. Now when the snake bites, I suddenly feel severe pain. And I see the snake slithering. You snake, how dare you bit me? Now I will beat you. And I start running after the snake to catch it and to crush it with my feet. Now even if I reach the snake and I start pounding it, even if I crush it and I crush it to death, what is happening? Actually, in the process of running and pounding, the poison is spreading through my body.
hand, I may kill the snake, but I'll kill myself. The snake has to be dealt with. It's a danger, it has to be dealt with. But right now, if the snake has bitten me, my first goal is to get safe. Get safe means get the poison out of my system. After I get the poison out of my system, the source of the poison, I will deal with appropriately. Then I can go and kill the snake, or either somebody else can be called to kill the snake, or somebody may come and take the snake and put it in an enclosure. Whatever needs to be done, we'll do it afterwards. Similarly, when something goes wrong, the first thing we need to do is, we have to get rid of the resentment. Yes. Now, usually we think of emotions only in two terms. Either we express the emotion, or we repress the emotion. Now, if somebody has hurt me, we become angry and we vent out, explode at that. Or sometimes we repress. No, I'll not speak. Now, the Bhagavad Gita explains that we need to go beyond expressing emotions and repressing emotions to processing emotions. We need to process our emotions. Process means that we have to dispassionately be able to think about the emotion. Okay, this is the emotion, what caused it? And then how should I deal with it? So the impulsive reaction to it is usually not a beneficial reaction. So when we resent, when we become angry, we just vent out the emotion. When we repress the emotion, we are trying to wish away or deny the emotion. Neither is going to work. The emotion is there, and when I express it, usually it makes things worse. When I deny it, it's there. How can I wish it away? It's there. So we have to process it. And the whole process of processing emotions is what Bhakti Yoga is about. Bhakti Yoga centers on purifying our emotions. When our emotions are purified at that time, we also can process our emotions better. The Bhagavad Gita is not just about chanting Hare Krishna, going to the temple. It's about developing inner awareness by which we understand our emotions. Bhagavad Gita says we have to become conscious of our consciousness. We become conscious of our consciousness. You know, what kind of emotions are coming? Why are they coming? What is the appropriate response to them? When we do this, then we will be able to process them. And after processing, we will be able to decide how best to respond to it. Resentment is something which we need to give up. Resentment, giving up, doesn't mean that we become passive. It simply means that we don't let the negativity be our driving force. We let the negativity deal with it. We stimulate our intelligence, and using our intelligence, we appropriately deal with the situation. Usually, with respect to physical issues, if, as I said, my software is damn, my computer is cracked, it's very easily visible. So similarly, if say I got a fracture in my hand, it's very easily visible. But when there is a mental pattern that is harmful, it is not so easy to see that. So resentment, the process for curing resentment, it begins with recognizing that it is harmful. So after we recognize resentment is harmful, we can send resentment on retirement. We can send it out of our consciousness. Now, how to do that? That we'll discuss tomorrow. I'll summarize right now, and then we can have some questions if there are.